just want to thank you so much for having me join you tonight. I really am privileged to be able to share with you this evening, and so encouraged by the relationship our churches have together. It's really humbling and it's really powerful to think about these three churches living so close to one another and so heavily invested in one another's lives. And as I think about where we're going to head over the next 50, 60 years, where this next generation of leadership in the church is going to take us, I really think we're getting a foretaste of what we're going to see more of in the years to come. I really think the relationships that we have is what God is going to do more and more of. And for revival and breakthrough to take place in our city, in Melbourne, I think we are on the edge of what it's going to look like, what it's going to take, something like we've never seen before, where the body of Christ, the body of Jesus actually unites and stands with one another. And it becomes so hard to work out our differences, we forget about it, and we worry more about what connects us and what joins us. And so I'm so privileged to get to share with you with the heart and the spirit that we carry towards one another. Hey, I want to ask you a question to get started tonight. What would you do for $100? What would you do for $100? I've seen people do some crazy things for money, eating whole bowls of chilies, doing all sorts of crazy things, trying to jump across pools in the hope that they don't fall in the pool and make it to the other side, all sorts of crazy things for $100. Well, if you're a uni student, you know that the correct answer to that question is just about anything. When you're at uni, you've got to do whatever you can to get an extra buck, because money gets you lunch this week. And you know, as a uni student, you don't run off the economy of dollars and cents. You're on a different economy. It's called the two-minute noodle economy. And everything is worked out according to how many packets of two-minute noodles you can buy with that set amount of money. And a student, uni student knows that right now at Coles, you can get 5 packets of two-minute noodles for $3, and it's a good bargain. That's a whole week's worth of lunch for $3. And so uni students will do whatever they can to get a little bit of extra money. And you'll work crazy jobs to do it. When I was at uni, I did some crazy jobs. The hardest job that I did, without question, was when I worked for my dad. My dad's a bricklayer. And so I went to work for him as a brickie's labourer. And so every summer holidays, every uni break, every moment that I wasn't at uni, I was working for my dad as a brickie's labourer. And brickie's labouring is the hardest job. It's backbreaking stuff. You spend all day walking around the job site, carrying wheelbarrows of bricks, mixing up mud for the bricklayers, pushing that around the site, sort of 100, 150 kilos a wheelbarrow, pushing it around, setting everything up so the bricklayers can just stand and put bricks on the wall all day. Do nothing else. You do everything else for them. You get them cups of water when they're thirsty. You do all sorts of stuff just so they can put bricks in the wall. The more bricks they put on, the more money we get paid. And so I spent all of my summers doing this, and in a 40-degree day with no shade, it's a hard job. I would drink 3-4 litres of water a day, come home exhausted, dehydrated, just basically flop into bed, get up and let the magic happen again the next day. It was a great job. But winter was much worse. Winter was far worse than summer. Because in winter, job sites turn into mud holes. They just turn into a whole quagmire of mud. And you spend the whole day pushing these wheelbarrows through mud, slipping and sliding, tripping over, falling into the mud, getting covered in all of it. And I would come home at the end of the day, stinky, smelly, head to toe covered in mud. My shirt and my shorts would be getting ripped as I'm trying to do my job. I wasn't the best at it, so I was pretty clumsy and dropping things everywhere. And so it was the hardest job through winter, because everything would be full of mud. One day we were working on this massive mansion in Bourne. I'm talking like huge, 3 stories, underground car park, you know, this amazing house for this family. They're actually the owners. The person that we're building this house for was the owner of a big building company. And so they were getting the company to build them their house, I suppose, maybe for a bit on the cheap, but I don't know. It was enormous, this mansion. And as I was slaving away in this midwinter's day, covered in mud, I turned around and looked, and these 2 amazing cars rocked up in front of the house, a Mercedes and a BMW. The two of them parked there, and 3 or 4 guys got out of each car, and these guys looked incredible. They're in their awesome suits. perfectly put together. Hair perfect, ties all well done up. They looked incredible as they got out of their perfect, beautiful cars. And I realized one of the guys was the owner of this mansion. As they rocked up and were pointing to the mansion, he was on his lunch break bringing his mates to come have a look at the brand new mansion that we were building for him. And as they came around the corner, I saw their shoes, these amazing, beautiful leather shoes that just looked incredible. And I thought, that's like 320 2-minute noodles on each foot. It was incredible. And as they walked up to the front of the mansion, they looked at the front door and they got to the end of the footpath and they stopped. And they were looking around, and I realized pretty quickly they were looking for a clean way from the footpath to the front door to get in and have a look at this mansion. And there wasn't a clean path. It was mud right the way through. And after a little bit of considering, I sort of thought, oh, well, we better just have a go at getting across this mud. And so they started tiptoeing across the mud like this, hoping that none of it would get on their beautiful 320 2-minute noodle shoes. And as they tiptoed, it was only two or three steps, I saw sheer desperation sweep across their face. As not only did they get some mud on their feet, but their shoes began to sink down into the mud completely. And not just their shoes, but their suit pants were going with it. And mud was creeping up their legs as they walked to the front door of this mansion. And I pushed past with my barrow of bricks, covered in mud, stinky, smelly, kind of laughing to myself. And I thought, we could not be any more different right now. Here's you with your rich buddies in your awesome car, on your lunch break, still getting $150 an hour, probably coming to look at your incredible mansion in your amazing suit with your ridiculous shoes, standing next to me, the uni student with nothing, getting my $15 an hour, just trying to work my way through life, covered in mud, stinky, smelly. We could not be any more different right now. And the mud that's covering us could not mean any more opposite to us. For you, it's a disaster. It's terrible. For me, I don't care at all. And so many people think about God in exactly the same way, that he could not be any more distant. He could not be any more irrelevant. He could not be any further away from the reality of the life that we deal with and live through each and every day. The God that is marketed and talked about and people try and share about could not be any further away from the reality of life that we deal with day in, day out. And when people say that, talk about Jesus, it's just this guy from another generation, 2,000 years ago and another time, another culture. He could not be any more irrelevant, any more distant from life that we live today. And then religious people tell stories about God that only seem to back that up, that only seem to further the thought that God could not be any more distant or out of touch than he is. Around December each year in our culture, we have this thing called Christmas. You might have heard about it once or twice. And we tell beautiful stories of a baby. Beautiful, clean, amazing stories of hope that are so well packaged and so well edited. Away in a manger. No crib for a bed. The little Lord Jesus lays down his sweet head. The cattle are lowing. The baby awakes. But little Lord Jesus, no crying he makes. If you're a parent or you've ever babysat, you know that's garbage. Babies cry. They smell. They keep you up at night. It's not easy. It's not this beautiful, clean picture having kids. It's hard work. And then we tell stories about this baby that's perfect without any problems, that doesn't bring any dysfunction or challenge to life, and it couldn't be any more irrelevant or distant to the life that we experience day in, day out. And I want to tell you tonight that God is far from the distant, irrelevant, out of touch figure that so many people think he is. But he is up to his eyeballs in the mud and the mess and the dysfunction of this world. He is so relevant. He is so close. He is so much in the muck of this world that it would make you feel uncomfortable to actually grasp what he's doing. It makes you feel awkward when you get to grapple with just how involved he is. You'd kind of look at him and think, I feel a bit sorry for you dealing with all of that. God is so involved in the muck, in the mess. He has covered himself head to toe in the dysfunction of this world. And I want to read to you, well, I don't need to read to you actually. Grant has read to us a scripture from Matthew that only seems to accentuate that thought that God is distant, irrelevant, and out of touch. Only seems to add to the thought that he could have nothing to do with life as we live it today. Matthew is starting his argument about who Jesus is. He's trying to convince you that Jesus is the promised Messiah. Matthew writes to a Jewish audience. We know this because he keeps on saying throughout his story that Jesus did this to fulfill this prophecy. This happened to fulfill what this prophet said. Matthew keeps referring to the Jewish Bible, the Old Testament, as a way of proving that Jesus is the promised Messiah. And so he starts off his story wanting to prove to a Jewish audience who Jesus is. And you would know if you've ever gone to see a great movie or read a great book that you've got to start well. When you go and see James Bond, you start with lights and action and things blowing up and people shooting each other. When you read a really good book, the first chapter is awesome. Because the director and an author knows that if you're going to read the whole book, if you're going to sit through the whole movie, they've got to grab you right from the start. Matthew didn't go to director's school. He didn't quite grasp the importance of starting well. So Matthew, picture it, you're sitting on your couch, you've heard this great book called Matthew about all the wild adventures of Jesus and the incredible things that he did and said and how your life could be changed by him, and you're sitting on the couch with your coffee and cookies, ready to read this incredible book. You open it up, you're all loaded, you're set, you're right to go, and this is the first thing that you read. This is the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now, I just fell asleep halfway through the first line. What are you doing, Matthew? How could you start with a family tree? How could you start talking to us about Jesus' family tree? Now, I'm about to offend a few people, so I want to apologize ahead of time. Don't judge me too harshly. I have a little bit of interest in my family tree. It's kind of, you know, it's interesting. I have little to no interest in yours. I'm just saying. Unless you got some royal blood, I don't care. I'll be honest. And the only people who go to ancestry.com are retirees, people with nothing to do, or archaeological students. But they're boring anyway, so it wouldn't be a surprise that that's what they'd do. Anyone an archaeology student, actually? Nothing to worry about then. Why would you start with a family tree? It could not get any more boring. But to the Jewish audience that Matthew writes, if you could show that you're a descendant of Abraham, of David, you're part of a family where there were some powerful things promised about your family. Your family was, or your line was one that God was going to bring redemption and hope and transformation from. God was going to do significant things through this line. And so if you could point to that, you could make a claim on being the Messiah. So Matthew is showing a Jewish audience that Jesus stacks up. He stacks up to be the Messiah that was promised. But Matthew does it in a very strange way. Because Matthew starts airing some dirty laundry in Jesus' family tree. You would think if you were trying to prove that you were the Messiah, God's own son, you would talk about all of the good things in your life, all of the reasons why you stack up. But instead, Matthew starts listing all of the skeletons in the closet in Jesus' family. All of the things that you want to sweep under the carpet and forget. Matthew starts listing these things. He starts telling us things about Jesus' family that are baggage, that are dirt, that are muck on Jesus. He starts naming all of these things. in this family tree. It's a rather unconventional way of trying to point out that Jesus is the promised Messiah. But Matthew wants to highlight something to you. He wants you to know in this family tree that if you've been asking the question, how could God use me in my life? How can my life count for something? If you found yourself wondering what it would take for God to be pleased with you, wondering what it would take for God to step into your life, Matthew wants you to have an answer as to what it takes. He wants you to know what it will look like for God to use you in your life. So he starts naming some of these skeletons in the closet, and he says to you, whatever you thought before you came into this story, you've got to leave that bag at the door. Because this Jesus, this Messiah, this God that I'm going to tell you about is nothing like what you thought. He's nothing like what you thought. You've got to leave your bags and your preconceived ideas at the door, because this Jesus, this Messiah, is nothing like you've ever seen or encountered before. Matthew starts listing some rather interesting people in Jesus' family tree. Jesus is from a royal line. And so he has some kings in his family tree. Ahaz and Manasseh are two kings that Matthew names. And these guys were idol worshippers. These guys worshipped idols. They led Israel away from God. They led Israel into captivity. They led Israel away from all that God wanted them to be. They worshipped idols. And you might say, oh, well, freedom of religion. You can do whatever you want. They just chose their own faith journey. But it wasn't just that. These guys were evil men. These guys, in order to worship the gods that they knew weren't real in the hope that they would please the kings next door and get in their good books, they killed their own children. They killed their own children to appease gods that they knew weren't real because they wanted to impress the kings that lived next door. And they didn't just kill their own children, they burnt their children alive. These are evil men. Jesus doesn't come from a family of good people. In his ancestry, in his family tree, are kings, are leaders, are people with power who abuse that power and harm others. These guys burn alive their own children to please the king next door, to appease a God that they know isn't real. This is Jesus' family. And if you found yourself thinking, God couldn't use me, God couldn't use someone like me, there's too much brokenness and dysfunction and stuff going on in my life, God couldn't use me as I am right now, Matthew wants you to know right now, you've got to leave that bag at the door when you follow Jesus. Because God can bring redemption and hope into any situation, into any family. If he can turn around a family like this with these guys, he can do something with the brokenness that you have in your life right now. And if you found yourself looking at someone else and thinking, God could never use them, God couldn't bring about change in their life, the things that they say, the things that they do, the stuff they believe, God wouldn't use them. Matthew wants you to know, you've got to drop that bag when you're walking with Jesus. Because he can redeem anyone, any situation, any family. Nothing is out of his reach. Nobody is too far gone. Even these evil, evil kings, their legacy, God chooses to use to bring about the greatest redemption and hope our world would ever see in Jesus. Matthew names some other interesting people. He names some women in this family tree. You might say, oh, there's nothing good about that. Of course you need women in order to have the next generation. That's not all that profound. But you would only name father to father in a family tree. You wouldn't list out the mothers as well. And for most of this family tree, that's what Matthew does. Except on four occasions, he starts naming some women. And it makes you stop and think, why are they there? What's Matthew trying to say about these women, why have they managed to work their way into this family tree? And surely it's because they're good, upstanding, strong women of faith that led Israel through their dark times into good times and into a great future. And surely they're women that exemplify everything it is to be right with God, that live pure lives, that live holy lives, that honor God with all that they are. But three of these women live the most sexually explicit stories you could imagine. Three of these women are caught up in the most scandalous stories in Israel's history. One of them is a prostitute. In Jesus' family tree is prostitution. Her name's Rahab. She was a prostitute in the city of Jericho. And she wasn't just a prostitute, but she had the undesirable story where she showed herself to be very untrustworthy as well. She turned her back on her city, on her people. She betrayed them to let spies from Israel's army in. And as a result, the whole city was wiped out except her and her family. So Rahab the prostitute, who turned her back on her people to jump on board with the side that she thought was going to win the war in the end, is one of Jesus' ancestors. Prostitution in this Messiah's family tree. That's a skeleton you'd probably rather sweep under the carpet if you're going to be the Messiah. But the next story is a whole lot worse. The next story is whacked. I don't know how else to describe it. One woman, her name is Tamar. And Tamar's story, she dressed up and pretended to be a prostitute so that her father-in-law would sleep with her and get her pregnant so she could have a child. That's incest. In Jesus' family tree. Prostitution, incest, lying, abuse of power. This is Jesus' family tree. This is the identity that he takes on in a culture where you're known by your heritage, by your family tree. This is the family tree that Jesus steps into. And there's another story. There's another woman. Her name isn't even given, but she's called the wife of Uriah, Bathsheba. You might know her story. I don't have time to tell it all, but Bathsheba, she had an affair with King David. She got pregnant, and David, trying to cover up his stuff, murdered her husband, one of his own soldiers. One of his soldiers were out risking his life for David. He had him murdered. And then lied to the country, lied to the nation, swept it all under the carpet. One of the most scandalous stories you could imagine. And this is Jesus' family tree. Murder, affairs, betrayal, lying, abuse of power, prostitution, incest. It doesn't get much darker than that. We have a saying that you can't choose your family, but you can choose your friends. Jesus chose his family. This is the family he chose. This is the identity he took on. This is the story that he became a part of. And Matthew wants you to know this. Matthew wants you to know right from the start that whatever bags you brought with you into this story, you've got to leave them at the door. Because this Messiah, this God, this Jesus is nothing like you have seen before. Nothing like you have ever known. Matthew writes to a culture, a Jewish culture, that is convinced that if you do the right thing, if you're a good person, if all of your morals and values are intact, are straight, are right, then God would accept you. Then God would love you. Matthew wants you to know right from the start, that's not how you please God. It's not how you get God on side. You don't impress him by living a good life. Your morals, your ethics, your values, they don't get God on your side. And don't hear me saying to you, I can go out and do whatever I want now. Fine, that's great. I can run and do whatever I want. That's not what I'm saying. Matthew wants you to know that your values, your ethics, your morals, they don't save you. He wants you to see that. Because out of the most broken family, God brings redemption and hope. Matthew wants you to know it's your heart. It's true faith. It's authentic seeking God that counts. And then what you do after that, you work out along the journey. But God is after authentic faith, a genuine heart, people that honestly seek him above all else. No matter the dysfunction and brokenness in their lives, they would put God first. Matthew writes into a culture that is convinced good people get saved. And we live in a culture that is convinced as long as you're a good person, you'll be okay. Whatever happens in the life after this life, we don't really know. But as long as you're a good person, it'll all work out in your favor. And Matthew wants you to know you've got to drop that bag at the door if you're going to follow Jesus. It doesn't matter how good you are. It doesn't matter how moral you are. It doesn't matter about your ethics and values. God is after your heart. He's after the real you. He's after what's going on the inside. And God will bring redemption and hope out of any broken situation, out of any struggle. Far from being like the rich guy in the suit, hoping that he could get through the mud with as little as possible on his shoes. God is not tiptoeing through your life, hoping to get as little of the mess of your life on him. He is instead diving into the muck and the mess with you. He's in the thick of it. Jesus didn't choose a family that had it all together, the perfect picture of life, to step into that family and be a model for how the rest of us should live. He instead chooses to step into a broken, dysfunctional, embarrassing family and make that his mess and take on that sort of dysfunction as his story, as his identity, as who he is. God is not turned off by the brokenness of this world. He steps right into it and becomes a part of it. And from there, he brings redemption and hope and transformation. If you found yourself thinking you needed to be better, you needed to be something more so God would come into your life, you're thinking about some other God. You're thinking about religion, some man-made thing that seeks to tell you you need to be something. The God of the Bible, Jesus, that Matthew tells us about, is more interested in who you are. He wants to step into your life with you, where nothing is off limits, where nothing is too bad, too wrong, too disgusting, too dark to be talked about. He wants to step into your life with you. And it's about the journey together, where nothing is off limits and your greatest mess will become his. He wants your mud to be what clothes him, to be what surrounds him. He wants to take it from you and wear it himself. This is the Jesus of the Bible. This is the Jesus that came to earth. This is how he lives. This is how he positions himself. This is how he wants to walk in relationship with you. I want to read you another scripture that we actually looked at earlier. I didn't know it was going to be read earlier, about another writer that writes to this same culture, this same context. Let me read to you what they say. Hebrews 4, verse 15 says, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way just as we are, yet he did not sin." Let me reword that for you for just a second. We do not follow a high priest, that is Jesus, who is distant and irrelevant and unlike us in every way. But because he stepped into our mess, because he stepped into the brokenness and dysfunction of our world and made it his, he's become like us in every way. He wants to take our mess, our mud, and put it on himself. But he does not add to the dysfunction. He does not add to the brokenness. And why does he do this? Let me read the next verse. "Therefore, let us approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need." Jesus takes on your mess so that you can approach the throne of grace. You can approach God himself without shame, without fear, without embarrassment, but you can walk boldly up to a throne of grace and receive your love, your forgiveness, your acceptance, just as you are. You don't need to change and become someone you're not. You don't need to change and take on a perfect life. But just as you are, God accepts you. Just as you are, he loves you. And just as you are, Jesus steps into the brokenness of this world and takes it on himself. We've got to quit trying to impress other people. We've got to quit trying to be like Ahaz and Manasseh, trying to make others happy and doing dysfunctional things as a result. We've got to quit trying to be people that we're not, when the throne of grace has been offered to us freely, without any extra expectation, full of love, full of acceptance. Because it's with an authentic heart of love, an authentic faith, that God brings redemption and hope. And the way we live our lives from that point is radically changed, but you've got to get the order right. You've got to start with an authentic faith and let everything else about your life be built from that point. Jesus chose the most dysfunctional family you could imagine so that you would know he loves you and accepts you and is for you, no matter what's happening in your life.